Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Weisop. Today we're doing a bonus episode. You know the deal. Once a month, all my supporters get access to the bonus episode. With all the great things in life, they get the ad-free experience. They get all the bonus content all the time. The Twin Peaks Grey Lodge. We did the Dark Path Book Club series a long time ago. Early access. My God. Books. What else is there? You know, and that's because, you know, that I load it up with perks because that's how much I value you guys supporting the show. So, it's a new year, which means we're going to start down the path of our one bonus episode every month. The month of January, the first one we're doing is Saltburn. Okay, we're doing a film analysis of a movie called Saltburn. And it's got I'll be honest, the symbolism in this is a little more subdued than most of the time. All right, I watched this movie two times, a third time kind of, and I saw some major themes of the sex and death, rebirth ritual, Luciferianism, Minotaurs, Molochs, and labyrinths, oh my. So today we're going to walk through this whole film, and it gives us a little bit of symbolism of many different things. We're talking about themes of child abuse, sexual taboos like incest, royal bloodlines, Solomon's Temple, Moloch, doppelgangers. Shout out to all my Twin Peaks fans out there. We're going to, of course, everything's related to Twin Peaks because they were the first ones to do it. They did it. When I was a wee lad, didn't know what was going on back in 1990, but now I do. We got a little talk about Lord Byron again. And you could tie that into Twin Peaks too, yes. Percy, Mary Shelley. What else? Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, Bohemian Grove, The White Stag, all that symbolism is loaded in here. But ultimately, it's about the desire of this young man, the protagonist, and a bit of play on Freud's Eros and Thanatos. These are the drives of love and death. This one's going to have it all, folks. It's going to have it all. So this is the bonus episode for January. And I must note that on my Patreon, I did a poll about swearing, and the results were about what I kind of thought. Roughly 20-30% of the audience not really feeling the swearing, and the rest of the people very supportive of it. So I appreciate that. The other, 70%-ish. Thank you very much for, most people said, just do you, man. Just make your art and just do it, bro. Quit asking. And I'm not doing it because I'm unsure of myself. I'm doing it because I value your opinion, and I'm here to serve you, right? I know some people just say, I'll say what I want. I don't give a damn. That's not really me. I'm trying to, ultimately, I'm not going to swear on the show because I think that I know I look like a total scumbag, but I have a very professional day job. I've got a master's degree, and I've been in a lot of positions at work that required me to be very professional and speak well, and it would be a shame to just throw that all out the window. You know what I mean? A lot of people have difficulty public speaking or removing tics or swearing and things like that. And, I feel like I've done a pretty good job at trying to make all those things happen. So I thought, why do that, right? I'm not trying to distract from the message because ultimately I'm trying to add a bit of seriousness along with the fun of talking about all the symbolism and the occult and the Illuminati and all these things, right? So, yeah, ultimately, I'm not going to swear. I'm not going to do it. So, but that being said, today's episode's going to have some swearing in the movie. We're going to play movie clips, and, if you saw the movie, you're not a fragile person, okay? If you waited through this whole movie. So, anyways. Thank you for your support. I appreciate you guys out there saying, dude, just do you, bro. And I appreciate that. And also, this is, if you're on the tier, I had a lot of people sign up for tier 2 on the Patreon or the VIP section, which means you're going to watch the video version of this show sometimes. I don't know what people's, how they consume the content. But tier 2 gives you access to the talking head version. This is like the YouTube version of me talking to you through the video camera. But today is one of those film analysis, so I'm going to drop in some clips that you can watch So yeah, tier two is, and I lowered the, in case you didn't know, I lowered the price from $20 to $10 for tier two, because to me, it didn't make sense to do it at $20. It really didn't. And, if you're on the Patreon, I'm going to throw another reminder out there. If you're on Patreon on the old tier two at $20 a month, you have to be the one to manually put yourself back down to the $10 a month. Okay. I will still give you the access to the thing. Some people want to pay more. Hey, man, like, I appreciate that. I'll take all the support I can get. So I'm not telling you got to do it. But if you want to, you know, you want to get the same perks for just $10 a month, save a few bucks, you got to be the one to do it. But the VIP section, folks, I already manually moved my tier two $20 a month down to the tier two $10 a month. They're already taken care of. But the Patreon, I don't have access to that. So be sure to do that. Or if you're on tier one, maybe consider bumping it up to tier two. I don't know. A lot of people did. But that's the main major difference between tier one and tier two is you get the video version. Some people prefer it. They're at work. They load it up. You know, it's a bunch of private ad-free Rumble links is where I upload the video currently. So some people prefer it. So that's the option. Also, another reminder, Rockfin. Rockfin's now a free feed. I know people got upset. They're like, oh, I'm a free feed loser now. Yes, I'm very sorry. I know. I've apologized for it. I will continue to apologize for it. I know that's shitty because I know I've followed people and then they move around. They're like, okay, I got to go over here. And it's just show business in a way, right? This is how it works. Sometimes things don't work out for whatever reason. My exposure on Rockfin hasn't been great. So it's not working out for me there. So I'm going to make it a free feed for a while and see if that's working. So far, it's not working. So the future does not look bright for me on Rockfin. I think it's just, I don't know if my content is just too different from the, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy people on there that are still talking about the pandemic. I don't know. But that's what people want. So, and I'm not doing that. So I don't know. Maybe it's just not for me. And that's okay. You know, I love Rockfin. Like, they let me, they give me a good home there. So, I don't know. Yeah. If you're on the Rockfin, you're stuck on the free feed loser status. I'm very sorry. If you want to do all the things, you know where to go. Patreon.com. Or, if you're on Rockfin, leave a comment on this video. If you're very salty about it, I understand. Leave a comment and, we'll see if we can work something out. Okay. All right. Moving on. Let's get into Saltburn. Should you watch it? Yes. Ultimately, I thought it was a great movie. It's something different. It's very much rated R. All right. Intended for adults. I'm going to stomp. Do not watch this with your kids around. Unless you're, you know, I was raised in a very socially liberal household. And my dad would have let me watch this when I was young. Because I wasn't raised soft like that. You know what I mean? But now I got a lot of damage I'm trying to undo, so I don't know. Was that a component? Who knows? I'm not here to tell you how to raise your kids. You do you. I'd argue that some teenagers, maybe they could watch it, but that's proceed at your own caution, okay? Some people are definitely not going to vibe with this movie at all. For me, I loved it. I'm a degenerate. Proceed accordingly. And I've got a litmus test for you. This will determine if you, based on how you feel about this quote I'm going to read you from the director, this will determine if you should watch this movie or not. Okay, are you ready? Are you ready? Here we go. The director said, in response to this film, the thing is, we're all disgusting perverts, aren't we? Now, how do you feel about that quote? If you're offended by that, if you think that's a gross thought to have, maybe you shouldn't watch it. If you laugh at that and say, you know what, maybe I'm a little bit of a disgusting pervert too, then hey, maybe this is your movie. Huh? What do you think? But that's kind of your litmus test for what you're in for if you watch Saltburn. Also, if you like gothic horror a little bit, you know, this fits the bill. It's gothic fiction stuff, like a little bit of Mary Shelley, a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe. Because gothic always has those real kind of spooky, haunting feelings, unnerving throughout the film. And it usually deals with the subjects of life and death, desire, heartbreak, struggles of power, and the darker sides of life. And that's kind of what this is about, all right? Okay. How long is it? It's 2 hours, but a blast by very quick. Great job, director. What is your name? Emerald Fennell. She did great. Who's in it? I don't know. Bunch of people. Bunch of English people. I had no clue who any of these people were. you know. But Isaac, Barry Keoghan, he won the Academy Award or whatever. Look, folks, I'm way less cultured than you may think I am, all right? My white trash blood runs deep, okay? I didn't recognize any of these people at all. But I don't consume the highbrow content that some of these English actors would probably be, and so there's that. The director, she did another movie that I did see called Promising Young Women. I didn't love it. It was fine. It was overhyped when I watched it. They act like this was the greatest movie ever made, and I watched it. I was like, it's fine. She has a very strong female perspective, you know, which I'm cool with, right? I'm cool with that. It's produced by Margot Robbie. Yeah, that's right. Margot Robbie from Barbie. You know, Barbie was another sort of female-focused film that did very well. And now we've got another one, Saltburn, that did very well. And I like that. I appreciate that. In fact, if you listen to, I do a podcast called Breaking Social Norms with my wife, Josie. Very controversial show. And because we let it all hang out there, all right? Probably more information than you could ever want about us. And we talked about this topic. We actually did a whole show about Saltburn. For like 2.5 hours, we talked about Saltburn. It wasn't what this show is. This show is going to be symbolism and ideas of the occult. That show was more of our feelings about it, our thoughts about it. Josie, who's my female companion, of course, the female gaze, what women find sexy about the movie, why they find it sexy, and you know all those things we unpack. We're not doing that here, right? Two different shows, two different styles, two different formats. But if you want more, Breaking Social Norms has another 2.5 hours of this. Or maybe you're on the free feed status, and it's not your month to support the show. You can go check out Breaking Social Norms. It's free. You know where to go. It's on BreakingSocialNorms.com or just find us on the podcast stuff. Also, interestingly enough, the film was shot at like where the Saltburn is the name of the estate. All right. I don't know where they come up with these names. But anyway, it was filmed at a place called the Drayton House in Northamptonshire in England. I looked it up. I didn't see any sort of Rothschild, Rockefeller, Illuminate confirmedness like I would expect, like from Eyes Wide Shut, right? Remember? Was that filmed at a Rothschild mansion? I didn't catch any of that on my research, so there's that. Okay. All right, you ready to dive into this movie? Who's ready? Come with me. Join along as we find out how much of a disgusting perverts we all are. Okay, plot spoilers coming. Let's go. It starts out, our main character, Oliver, he's played by that Barry Keoghan guy. Interesting looking fella. And he's narrating from this chair in this room about this preppy guy named Felix. And we hear how Oliver loved Felix. But he questions out loud. He says, but was I in love with him? And that sets up the whole movie, okay? I'm gonna double spoil you here, but that scene when he's talking from that chair is like present day, okay? And he's looking back. The whole movie's a flashback, all right? And they flash back to college. We're at Oxford, 2006, and they play an intro song, and I listened and it had lyrics about King Solomon, so I looked it up, right? And it's a song called Zadok the Priest by Handel. And it's an anthem that apparently they perform anytime a new British monarch is coronated. This goes back hundreds of years. And the song is based upon the biblical account of a high priest named Zadok. And Zadok anointed King Solomon himself. He was the first high priest to serve in the Temple of Solomon. Now, if you've been liking and subscribing to this podcast, you know we did 2 episodes about the end of the world and what's going on in Israel right now. Well, as it turns out, the Solomon's Temple is part of the required ritual in creating the final apocalypse, We talk about this on this show all the time. We talk about the ritualistic elements of the occult and their beliefs and their supernatural metaphysical beliefs of how they're going to manifest new realities. And it all points towards the Temple of Solomon. And what do you know? There's that song about with the first high priest of the Temple of Solomon. What does it mean? Are the Brits trying to also usher in the end times? I'm sure they are. All right, so it's 2006. Oliver is on campus at Oxford. He portrays himself a very nerdy, quiet freshman. He's just staring longingly at the circle of preppy, popular kids, Felix and Farley. Felix kind of looks like Ashton Kutcher a little bit. It's very, you know, it looks like an Abercrombie model, right? And he makes, and Oliver, he's forced to make friends with another nerd, Michael Gaby, and Michael's a math genius. He's even got some nerd anger, right? He lashes out, demanding Oliver ask him to give him an equation to solve. And this guy's role is very minute in this film. This Michael Gaby character, this other nerd, almost forgettable. So Oliver, maybe the purpose is just to show you that that's Oliver's people, the nerds. Not the preps, the Abercrombie model. So Oliver, he goes to this tutor, and we hear in this scene a few times, they talk about how Oliver comes from a town called Prescott, which is where, I don't know, blue-collar folks live, middle class. And then Felix's friend Farley shows up. And Farley, of course, is very late. But the tutor overlooks it because he knows Farley's family, right? They've all been to this college, and they're all rich, and that's why Farley's there, and he could care less because this means nothing. And the counselor, the tutor, is like, oh, yeah, I knew your mother. I was an admirer myself. So the whole scene is Farley trying to take Oliver down a peg. And there was an assignment they had over the summer before they started college to write this essay about some books. Oliver did it, and Farley obviously did not. And he's trying to take Oliver down a peg. And, you know, Oliver's like, oh, yeah, well, I can't wait to hear yours, knowing that he did not actually do the assignment. So Farley's kind of a moron. Oliver's kind of intelligent, all right? And Farley is also very rich. He's a part of a noble bloodline, if you will. So Oliver sees, he's riding his bike on campus, and he sees Felix, Mr. Abercrombie there. And Felix, he's got a flat tire in his bike, and he's just sitting against the tree. And Oliver says, hey, what's up, man? Your bike got a flat? And Felix is like, yeah, man, and I got to be at the class in 10 minutes. I'm not going to make it. And it just goes to show you, because, you know, normal people, if they got a flat, they would probably just grab their bike and hoof it to the class to try to get there on time. But he's a rich kid, right? Silver spoon. He ain't worried about it. None of it matters. Why even try? But Oliver, he says, well, here, take my bike, trying to befriend this popular prep kid. And this is the beginning of their relationship, all right? And they're hanging out on campus and doing a bunch of stuff. And no, I'm sorry. Let me back up. So he gives him the bike. And then the next scene, Oliver and his nerd friend Michael, they're at the pub that all the college kids hang out. And Michael, he goes for a slash, whatever the heck that means. I guess take a piss. I don't know. And Felix sees Oliver and calls him over to the cool kid table, right? And Oliver's been waiting for this moment, so he straight up ditches Michael. He's like, see you later, dork. I'm hanging out with the Abercrombie models. So they drink all night. It's Oliver's turn to buy a round, but, you know, he's poor white trash. He can't afford it. So Oliver begs the bartender. He's like, look, I ain't got no money. I'll pay you tomorrow. I'll figure out a way. Felix sees all this going on, and he actually goes over there and spots Oliver the money very covertly and very nicely. And you think, well, that's kind of nice of him, right? Nice guy. He seems all right. Okay. Then they're hanging out on the campus. They're getting closer. They're becoming buddies. A lot of cool party sequences. And you've got this blossoming bromance of Oliver and Felix, who You know, he shows him how to smoke some and gives him some family dirt because, you know, Farley is Felix's cousin. And they're sitting around and Oliver asks about, I think they were talking about a private school and what Felix's life was like going to a private school. Because presumably Oliver went to a public school because he's poor. All right. And listen to what Felix says about what he learned at the private schools.
It's DJ fucking
Shadow. He's fucking chronic, mate. All these boarding school psychos. What did they teach you?
Latin, water polo, and child abuse.
Felix says that they taught him Latin, water polo, and child abuse, right? I'm thinking that Felix was abused as a child, or he witnessed it, or one of his friends did, or something like that. Why does Felix say this? I'm guessing he's saying that school in general is just a waste of time for an elitist like him. Because Latin is a dead language. Who cares about water polo? It's not a real sport. I know all the water polo athletes out there. What the hell, man? Those guys do look ripped, though. But that leaves the last thing he talks about he was exposed to was child abuse. And his world seems to have a fair amount of this going on if you pay attention throughout the movie. But it's very subtle. Like, all the symbolism in this movie, there's subtle things. And if you didn't have a great guide like me, you might not catch it all, right? Let's see. Where are we now? Okay, so we hear that, you know, Oliver talks about how his dad was a drug dealer and his mom was an alcoholic. And then we see Felix, he's literally able to just grab any girl he wants to go sleep with. Even though the guy was chatting her up for a nice little HJ, he still manages to swoop in and just grab a girl. Because that's the kind of guy Felix is. Everything is handed to that guy. So Michael, he, you know, the other nerd guy, he sees Oliver around campus and he calls him a bootlicker. Right? He's betraying his own kind by hanging out with the elites. Oliver is tailing Felix, and Felix is talking to a girl named Annabelle, one of his friends, and they're talking about how nobody wants to associate with Oliver. And Felix, he's kind of a nice guy, and he says, oh, that's a bit harsh, but he still laughs, right? And this is all about Oliver trying to get into the group the whole time, and he's not quite there. And Oliver watches Felix doing sexy time from outside of his window. Real creepy, right? It's getting creepy now. So Felix and Oliver, they have a bit of a spat about the heat and final exams. And Felix ditches Oliver to go to the pub. And Oliver sees him at the pub. And he's heartbroken because he's like, man, you invite me every time and I guess it's over now, right? And you'll see, and I'm going to put a photo on the Instagram and such. You'll see that Oliver is in front of a man that has some horns. And he walks out, and he walks by a sign that says, The Bull. I'm thinking the pub is named The Bull. And you already know where we're going with that. We got the, you know, is it the Moloch, the god of child sacrifice? Possibly. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. There are some horned entities in this movie. Maybe Moloch isn't quite the one, but we got to point that out. Oliver also sees that Annabelle got ditched as well. And she wants to go drink. So Oliver's like, come to my room. And they start making out and they're going to do it. And then Oliver blows it. Annabelle says, oh, do you think Felix will get jealous? And Oliver says, I don't think he's going to think nothing of it. And she gets mad and leaves. I'm like, bro, what are you doing, man? You're fumbling. So then Oliver finally, he rekindles with Felix by lying. Ooh, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Oliver rekindles with Phoenix because he gets a phone call from his mom and he tells Felix, he says, my dad just died. And Felix feels bad for him and they have a nice cry, whatever. Okay. School year's over, I guess. Everyone's celebrating. Felix invites Oliver to go to his family estate for the summer, Saltburn. And while they're doing it, Felix says, he's still trying to be a nice guy. He says, look, we have this family tradition where if someone dies, we put their name on a rock and we throw it into the river. So he invites Oliver to do that for his now dead father. And Oliver, he misses the whole damn river. It ends up on the bank and he's like, whoops. And here's something interesting here in this scene. Oliver says, the first time I felt the inside of mom's throat was when I was 8. And you're listening, and you're like, wait a minute, what? And then he goes on to say how what he's talking about is making his mom puke because she was an alcoholic. Either way, he's building sympathy and it works. There's lots of recurring themes of the inside of people's mouths in this movie. We talked about this on Breaking Social Norms. The only symbolism I could think of, it makes me think of Alien, about the ovipositor and how the facehugger alien will hug someone's face, inject eggs into their throat to host the new xenomorph baby, right? And it plays on some kind of weird primal fear of some kind. I don't know. There's something about the inside of the mouth, and I don't know. You see it in this movie many times. Either way, Felix is building sympathy. It works. And then we start with Act 2. Oliver shows up at Saltburn, this massive, beautiful estate, gated entrance, butlers, all that stuff. And you'll notice, and here's symbolism. I don't know what the answer is, but there's a truck, a toy truck at the front door. No idea why. Josie actually spotted that. It looks like it's been burned up or something. I can't tell. I'm not talking like a little toy truck, like a remote control truck or something, right? I don't know what it means. I still don't know. I watched the movie 2.5 times. So, okay. Where are we at? Okay, so Felix shows Oliver around the place. We've got, you know, he's showing him around. He's like, oh, look, I got, you know, Henry VIII's cabinet here and all these paintings by famous painters, Rubens, and this collection of Shakespeare. We've got a maze, the place where he accidentally fingered his cousin, all these things. Right, it's just rich people stuff, right? And that's no offense to rich people. It's impressive. It's an impressive collection. And Oliver notices a thing. It's this box that has these jesters in it, like little toy puppets, kind of. And the names are Felix, Venetia, James, and that's the names of the family. And it says along the top, the Catan players. Because that's the last name of Felix's family, the Catons. And I looked that up. The name Catan, it's got a lineage going way back. The family moved to the Americas in the 1600s. They had a motto on the crest that says, "The cautious wolf fears the snare." Which is actually ironically funny by the end of the movie. Kind of interesting. We'll come back to that. So Oliver gets in there and he's shown around, and then Felix's family, they're all in the one room. They're watching Superbad. They're gossiping. Then they're gossiping about Oliver and how he lives in this slum town called Prescott, and his family's full of addicts and all this stuff. And then Oliver walks in and they're like, oh, hey, buddy, what's up? You know, Felix tells Oliver, he's like, look, for dinner tonight, you got to wear a black tie. That's what we do here. But Felix makes sure he's got what he needs. See? Kind of a nice guy. Felix's sister, Venetia, she's outside. She's smoking cigarettes, right? And she notes to Oliver how it's almost a full moon. She also says her whole family is cold-blooded. She also says that she likes Oliver better than last year's one. What does all that mean? At this point in the movie, I'm thinking, did Felix bring somebody over last year? What happened to that person? Who was it? When she says her family is cold-blooded, are we talking about the reptilian shapeshifter people? Cold-blooded lizard people? Because David Icke talks about that, how the royals and the elites have they're cold-blooded lizards. And it's also the full moon coming soon. And, you know, people start acting weird around the full moon. I don't know. We'll see what happens. So the next morning, they're eating a little brekkie, and they're talking about Percy Shelley, how Percy Shelley had a doppelganger. And in this scene, if you watch it, you'll see how there is actually a doppelganger of Felix who walks past the window at the same time that they're talking. You'll notice there's a Felix is wearing a pink shirt at the brekkie table, and then a Felix with a pink shirt walks right past the window at the same time. We'll come back to the doppelganger in the conclusion. And Farley says that he thinks Percy Shelley banged his sister, but Oliver says, no, I think that was Lord Byron. All right. Now, Lord Byron appears in Twin Peaks Season 2 in one particular scene. But Lord Byron was a Romanticism era poet from the 1800s. He was a politician, hence the name Lord Byron. He had multiple lovers. He was possibly bisexual, a little bit of incest maybe, which you'll find those themes show up in Saltburn. In his journal, he wrote about how he was attracted to his cousin when he was 7. And there was rumors that he actually slept with his half-sister later on, and they had a child. You know, homosexuality was illegal back then. Incest, not so much. So the royals, they were notorious for inbreeding. Now, what's interesting here is that Lord Byron was close friends with Percy and Mary Shelley. And if you know the story of how the novel Frankenstein came about, it's because they went to a Johann Dippel's castle in Germany. And Johann Dippel was a prominent alchemist. And they had a contest about who could write the best novel, and Mary Shelley wrote the Frankenstein novel. Percy had written a novel called Prometheus Unbound, and he was into witchcraft and magic and channeling spirits. So they made quite the couple. These folks are Luciferians, all right? That's what we're getting at. They worship the idea of man's intellect to become the new gods, right? Man can achieve that status of God. And that's the attitude the royals have. And why wouldn't they, right? The elites in the film act accordingly. You'll notice it in the movie. And they're all hanging out. And now it's a new day. They're hanging out. They're naked in a field. They're sunbathing in a pond by a pond. They're reading Harry Potter. Because it's 2006, presumably, right? They're watching The Ring and Superbad. They're playing tennis with black tie suits on. I said it looks like a 2-hour cologne commercial. It was actually filmed very beautifully with everything. The scenery and the outfits and the people are all very good looking. And there's one part where Oliver pretends there's some ceramics in the Saltburn estate. And Oliver, he read in this book about the ceramics, and he acted like he knew. He's trying to fit in. He's like, oh, that's, so-and-so. And the dad was very impressed by this. He says, oh, very good, Oliver. You know, he's working his way in. Then there's a scene where he looks out over a maze. They have a labyrinth maze made out of the hedges in their yard, as royals do. And of course, the labyrinth is a maze in Greek mythology. And we see it in films such as The Shining. Let's look to a journal article by Vincent Jaunus called Inside the Interpretative Maze of The Shining, The Search for Meaning in Crisis. This author, Vincent, writes, this essay examines the hermeneutics. That's a big word. This essay examines the hermeneutics of The Shining in the light of the manifold overinterpretations that became apparent since the advent of internet forums and gained visibility with the release of Room 237. That's a documentary by Rodney Asher about The Shining symbolism. I suggest that, as highlighted by the motif of the labyrinth, Kubrick constructed a hermeneutic maze in which Jack, subject to hermetic thought, loses himself, while Danny, whose humility enables him not to fall into the traps of an organizing reason striving to make sense of a world impervious to human logic, escapes. In doing so, The Shining envisages its own reception through the staging of two conflicting viewing models. What is he talking about? Let me tell you what I think. This is what I think. I think he's saying that the internet allowed us to overthink films and symbolism in films. Shots fired at your boy. I guess I'm into hermeneutics. I never knew it. But that's kind of what he's saying. Is he wrong? I don't know. Maybe he is right. He's saying that in The Shining, Jack literally loses himself in the maze, while Danny is able to escape because he's not mature enough to get trapped into this hermetic thought that Jack is. And hermetics, it means trying to find meaning beyond what we experience through our five senses and learning that there's elements of things that are influencing us that we are unaware of. It ties into a lot of this hermeneutics, right? This idea of symbolism and the Illuminati and questioning what's real and all those things, right? Well, Danny, he's just a simpleton. He's a little kid. He don't think like that. He just literally finds his way out the maze. And Jackson are thinking about it, freezing to death. But the author is talking about how the internet enabled symbolism analysis. Let me read you. You're going to like this. The documentary Room 237 provides a handful of examples of what we shall call overinterpretations. We may think of the theory arguing that the director of 2001 A Space Odyssey disseminated clues in The Shining to secretly admit he had shot a fake moon landing for the U.S. government. I would also like to refer to the publication in 2014 of the book Kubrick's Code, in which Isaac Weishaupt argues that the whole filmography of the director aimed at warning the world against a secret plot orchestrated by the Illuminati for world dominion. The internet also hosts a website, SaturnDeathCult.com, in which we may find an analysis of The Shining as revealing the existence of an international occult sect organized around pedophilia and planned ritualistic transmutation of mankind. Yeah, but are we right? Aren't the conspiracy theorists right? And Saturn Death Cult's run by Troy McLaughlin. He was one of the people I studied for my first book, A Grand Unified Conspiracy Theory, because he talked about Saturn and the purple sheath and all kinds of wild stuff. He was making the rounds in the early podcast days. But how interesting is this, right? Is Vincent, I'm too stupid to understand what he's saying exactly. I think he's questioning, are we overthinking this thing? Are we overthinking it that maybe there's symbolism of an idea that there's a whole international occult sect organized around pedophilia and ritualistic transmutation of mankind? I think that's on the money.
I really do.
And I think with the whole Epstein deal, which I'm still waiting, any minute now they're going to drop the list, supposedly. We'll see. But yeah, isn't that interesting? And of course, I'm going to tell you about how they said they said my name. It was funny because I was researching for the labyrinth stuff because I knew it was in The Shining, and I thought I wrote about it in Kubrick's Code, but I didn't. I looked through the book. I don't see it. I was like, how did I not talk about this? And it shows up in Westworld. That was one of the times I talked about it was, and I think that was a blog article I wrote about Westworld that had to take down. Anyways, I was looking for Labyrinth's The Shining, and this is one of the first Google links was this journal entry. And lo and behold, I saw my own name. How bizarre. So of course I'm going to tell you about it. I have to push the clout. But anyway. The author goes on to talk about, it's a very highbrow article, about how the film can have these symbolic interpretations, which is kind of like a labyrinth. It's meant to induce vertigo in a way. So the labyrinth is a physical, this is my interpretation, the labyrinth is a physical manifestation of the mental hermeneutics of questioning everything, right? And that's why Jack gets stuck in it, because he's overthinking it. And like you kind of get, it's kind of like being wound around the axles about stuff. And that makes sense, because sometimes that's how this conspiracy theory world is. You start overthinking things and questioning everybody and being paranoid. All right, moving back to the movie. So Oliver, he's getting ready for bed, he overhears a little bit of moaning from the bathroom, and he looks into Felix's bathroom, and Felix is in there punching the clown in the bathtub. Okay? So Oliver does what anyone would do. He waits for Felix to get done, and he hurries up, and before the whole tub drains to the very bottom, he jumps into the tub, because Felix is now gone, and he licks the bottom of the tub clean. He slurps the little bit of water left from Felix's bath. That's right. And the camera zooms in. It's so uncomfortable. The camera zooms in. He's making love to this drain with his tongue. Oh, my God. Oh. I don't think I've ever seen anything more horrific in my life. I mean, it's implied there's semen in there. Felix's dirty bath water. You couldn't pay me enough money in the world. Well, you probably could. What's the lowest amount? I mean, let's be honest. Like, you pay my house off, I'll do it. I'll do it. Sign me up. I mean, it's just a little bit of grossness for a few seconds and you get to pay your house off. I'd say it's a fair trade. So that's the turning point of the movie where you say, wait a minute. Honey, put the kids to bed. They're not going to watch this movie. This movie's freaky. It's creepy. So the next evening, Felix's mom, she's basically the patriarch of the family because the dad, James, he's a total goofball. And mom, she can't stop gossiping either. But anyways, she's kind of running the show, even though it's the dad's family's money. So the next evening, the mother tells Oliver how Venetia is sexually incontinent since she was 14. That's the sister. Meaning that she's been obsessed with sex since she was 14. And you'll see there's a statue. I think the statue is of Theseus slaying the Minotaur, because obviously that makes sense with the labyrinth puzzle that has a Minotaur in the center of it that you see later. So Oliver, he's trying to chat up mom there, Elspeth. She's and tells her how beautiful she is and how, you know, some other guest left was sketchy or whatever, right? So later on, Venetia, the sister, she's outside Oliver's window. It's nighttime. It's the full moon. She's in a see-through gown. And Oliver goes out there to seduce her because she's messing around outside of his window late at night in a see-through gown. And he shifts gears, right? Now he's got this, like, boss-ass sexual energy. And he directs her to eat. And he's like, look, tomorrow you're going to eat. You're not going to throw any of it up. Because the mom, Elspeth, told him that she is a anorexic and a masochist and all this crazy stuff, right? And he's trying to be a bit of a dominator here, right? A bit of, what do you call it? You know what I'm saying? And he's like, he's going to go down on her. And she's like, no, it's that time of the month. And he says, don't worry, I'm a vampire. And he does so, and he starts playing with her blood, and he's got bloody fingers and lips, and he's putting his fingies in her mouth and kissing her, and there's blood everywhere, and they're both very into this, right? This is the second scene that people are talking about. And it's a full moon, right? And the full moon, of course, you got this double symbol of the femininity, because the moon is the lunar goddess, and the women's menstruation is tied to the 28-day cycle of the moon. So sort of a double play on the feminine there. So now it's next morning. It's brekkie. We hear that the Henrys are coming to dinner. Who knows who they are, whatever, friends. And Venetia says something about how the Henrys are going to molest her again, right? Applying again. And Elspeth says, well, we'll just sit Oliver next to you and he can molest you. Excuse me? So the question is, did Venetia get raped by the Henrys when she was 14 years old? Because she gets mad and she storms off. Okay. And then Felix, he's mad at Oliver for banging his sister. Oliver lies to him and says, look, she came on to me. She was trying to kiss me, and I didn't want to embarrass her, so I did what I had to do. And then we hear that a guy named Eddie was the friend that came over last summer, and he had a thing for Venetia, and it ruined their friendship, okay? Felix is, and look, and Felix has a matching tattoo with his sister, this tattoo of stars on their hand. I tried to find what this is about, like the meaning of star tattoos on the hand. It wasn't anything specific, but I went to Pop Sugar's website, and they said Venetia Catton may never be the Catton golden child, but that doesn't seem to waver her relationship with her brother Felix, at least not by much. It was very important for Emerald that there were elements of Venetia and Felix that mirrored each other, and that's how we played it with the tattoos, Miller says. That's the director. Whether it's simply the placement of certain ink, Venetia has a tattoo on the inside of her arm where Oliver has a carpe diem permanently etched. They share a cluster of stars on both of their hands. The siblings are physically linked one way or another throughout the film. And I think it's incest. I think Felix is messing around with his sister. That's why the last guy that was there, he had to kick him out because he's like, no, you're not going to, the only person banging my sister is going to be me. You know, these royal bloodlines, they do this incest stuff. So that's what I think is going on here. And there's more evidence throughout the film that you believe this by the time it's over. So Farley, he accuses Felix of being racist because the family isn't giving more money to his mom, whatever. Oh, and another thing that makes me think that Venetia slept with Felix, when the Henrys come over for dinner during that scene, Venetia says that Felix gets tired of his toys and stops playing with them, like she's jealous. Like she wants, like she's trying to get Felix to do it with her again. And they talked, remember they talked about earlier, they talked about Percy Shelley sleeping with his sister, you know. And then there's a scene, the next scene, they do karaoke and Venetia is sitting on Felix's lap. Very questionably, very strange. And during the karaoke scene, Oliver implies to Farley that, you know, he's moving up in the ranks. He's now being accepted as one of them. And he's like, look, I can work you a favor, Farley, since you're at odds with Felix. I can maybe make something work. And Farley tries to humiliate Oliver by making him sing a song by the Pet Shop Boys called Rent, and it's about sleeping with a guy to get the rent paid. So Oliver gets pissy. He goes to his room. He punches out the window. And then he shows up to Farley's room, and he pulls an alpha move on him, right? He mounts him. And it seems like he's either, I can't tell if he's either HJing him or F-ing him in the A. I can't tell. But you find out later that they definitely had a moment of intimacy. And you're like, bro, what? Is this guy gay? Is he bi? Is he straight? Nobody knows. So Oliver wakes up the next morning. His mirror is now fixed. And we find out that the mom kicked Farley out because he was trying to steal something. He had emailed Sotheby's claiming he could procure some of the art at the Saltburn house, but little did they know that James, the dad, he's friends with the owner. Of course he's friends with the owner of Sotheby's. They're all connected. So they kick Farley out. We hear that the first guest, at the beginning of the movie, there was a guest named Pamela, and they kicked her out because they were tired of her freeloading, and they find out that Pamela died. Okay, and it's just one of many deaths in the movie. We'll come back to the death part of this. So next, Felix surprises Oliver. It's his birthday, and he drives Oliver to Prescott, his white trash town, supposedly, to his mom's place. And Oliver's not comfortable with any of this. He's like, no, stop, turn around. Felix is like, no, I'm going to help you out, buddy. Your mom called me, and she really wants to see you. And they pull up. The house is nice. It's not slummy at all in Prescott. It looks real nice. Mom answers the door. She's totally sober. She's not drunk at all. Then Oliver's father shows up. He's not dead. Oliver lied. And worse yet, he's telling Felix about how, oh, yeah, we used to take Oliver to Mykonos every year. You know, it's a real Leave It to Beaver family. Not what Oliver was saying at all. He lied. And I think that's why when Oliver threw that stone, he didn't get it in the water. It ended up on the bank, on the dirt, because his dad wasn't dead. And then the second time I watched this movie, it was clear to me that Felix knew the whole time. He was just trying to catch Oliver in the act and embarrass him. Felix knew everything, right? Because that whole family, his whole family, his mom is a gossip queen. They know everything. I'm thinking Farley probably was pissed he got kicked out, and he looked up this Oliver guy and found out all the truths and told Felix, and Felix is like, all right, let's catch him in the act. It was very clear. So now Oliver's exposed. Felix drives him back to Saltburn, and he tells Oliver, like, look, buddy, we're going to throw your birthday party because it's your birthday. We had ours already planned out, but after that, you're out of here, dude, because you're a liar. So then on to the next scene. It's birthday party time. Act 3, I guess. Oliver's walking around. He's rocking these stag horns on his head. Because it's a Midsummer Night's Dream party. Now, an uncultured guy like me, I never seen it. I don't know what it's about. But A Midsummer Night's Dream is a famous play by Shakespeare. And recall that Felix said that they have all the Shakespeare novels at Saltburn, right? Which makes sense. But the play is about the marriage of Theseus and Hippolyta. Apparently it has multiple interpretations, but most of them relate to sex and or death. And we're going to revisit that in the conclusion. Fun fact, Farley, the guy who plays Farley, was actually in the movie Midsummer, the Ari Aster horror film, which is a great movie. So the Midsummer shows up there also. And you're also going to notice the Cat and Players puppet setup is literally at this, party. And you'll see, I'll put the image on there, but on the Instagram and everything, but the curtain and such, it's the setup to the entrance. And it's right by the statue of Theseus slaying the Minotaur. So we're watching a real live enactment of these puppets playing their game, right? So Oliver sees Farley, who tells Farley that, like, of course I'm back at Saltburn because I'm in the bloodline. You are not. You're a loser. This is your once-in-a-lifetime experience. You can only dream of this. Listen to how cold-blooded Farley is.
How did you know it was me?
Signet ring.
God, you really do notice everything, don't you?
Have they seen you yet?
Not yet.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ballistic.
I doubt it. They invited me. God, the look on your face.
They can't have invited you.
Oh, Oliver, you'll never catch on. This place, you know, it's not for you. It is a fucking dream. It is an anecdote you'll bore your fat kids with at Christmas. Oliver's once in a lifetime hand job on a hay bale, golden big boy summer. And you'll cling on to it and comb over it and jerk off to it, and you'll wonder how you could ever, 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 ever get it back. But you don't get it back. Because your summer's over. And so you catch a train to whatever creepy doll factory it is they make Olivers in, and I come back here. This isn't a dream to me. It's my house. Whatever happens, I always come back. Try hard the next time, baby.
Farley's mean. He's mean. He's vindictive. So then they have a big rave. Oliver's all the way back to square one now. He's watching Felix and Benicia, who won't give him the time of day again. Oh, all the way back down to the bottom, right? Felix and India, some chick, they go into the labyrinth, and Oliver, who's the stag, follows them. They get to the center, and they're banging it out at the statue of the Minotaur. All right? And Oliver's watching, as he does. And Oliver confronts Felix. He's like, I got to talk to you. And he's like, oh, great. Now I'm not going to get my action. And Oliver says to Felix, he's like, look, I was giving you what you wanted, a performance. He goes, everybody puts on a show for you. I'm sorry that my performance wasn't good enough. Felix tells Oliver that he makes his blood run cold, meaning he's frightened of Oliver. He's like, you're such a sneaky snake. You're scaring me. And let's revisit the stag again, because of course Oliver's wearing the stag horns. And there's this story about Nimrod, who was the great leader and a hunter, and his kingdom was starving. He was losing his ability to feed his people. But he saw this white stag as a symbol of prosperity and food coming back from his sons. The white stag was the symbol that led them to salvation. And in King Arthur's story, the white stag symbolizes mankind's spiritual quest to evolve. So it's interesting, we see Oliver as the white stag pursuing Felix. He's a bit of a hunter like Nimrod, but it's also a symbol of leading man to the spiritual rebirth, right? Oliver is the leader of his own destiny here, as you'll find out here shortly. So they have this big party, this big blow up. The next morning, nobody can find Felix. Everyone's screaming, looking for him. Elspeth finds him in the center of the maze by the Minotaur, dead. That's right. Felix wakes up dead. The goofy parents, they're in denial. They make everybody eat lunch and they pretend nothing's happening. The butler, he tries to close the lunchroom curtains so the coroner can wheel Felix's body past the windows. It puts this really weird red hue into the room. Farley says Farley's like trying to blame Oliver. He's like, oh, it's really weird that you're still here, Oliver. But Oliver points out, he's like, well, it's really weird you're here, Farley, because you were serving up lines of drugs to everybody last night, including Felix. Maybe that's how he died. So Farley shuts up real quick. So now we're at the funeral and they bury Felix. Everybody leaves except for Oliver, and he mounds the dirt above the casket. Pulls his pants down. Pulls them all the way down like a fourth grader taking a leak in elementary school at the urinal. Pulls them down to his ankles and proceeds to put his wiener in the dirt. Literally putting his dick in the dirt. And he's crying and he's banging the dirt above Felix. This is another one of the controversial scenes, obviously. And I think we'll come back to this. But what I'm going to say about it is you have the literal juxtaposition of sex and death here. On the nose a bit, if you will. So next, Venetia's taking a bath. Oliver walks in on her, and she kind of threatens to expose him a bit more, saying how she's like, oh, it's funny how hard you were crying because you barely knew Felix, which I actually don't think that made sense. I think they should have taken that out of the movie. It's like, no, they were bestying up for months. Why wouldn't he cry? That didn't even make sense to me, but whatever. And she's like, oh, you're just a stranger. Stranger effing danger, she says to him. She tells him how her daddy was calling Oliver the Spider-Man because he's always walking around and he's weaving his little webs. She's like, I think you're more of a moth. You're quiet. You're harmless. You're drawn to shiny things, a.k.a. rich people like them. And you're batting against the window. You're desperate to get in. And she puts her fingies in his mouth like he did to her earlier. Remember the fingies in the throat and the mouth? Very oral fixated, this movie is. And she freaks out. She's like, you're wearing Felix's aftershave, you creep. Why does she know what Felix's aftershave smells like? I think it's because she's making incest with Felix. And Bohemian Grove comes to mind here because the motto for Bohemian Grove is weaving spiders come not here. And she literally calls Oliver the Spider-Man. At the party, she was wearing a spider dress. And the Bohemian Grove's motto, weaving spiders come not here, means outsiders are not allowed to enter and hear what the business of the elites are doing. It's not for them. And guess where that quote comes from? It comes from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 2, Scene 2. I never seen it. That's what I read. So these things are all plugged in together, all right? So the next scene, turns out Venetia's dead in the bathtub, full of blood. Oliver tries to say, yeah, she was telling me how she couldn't live without Felix. Apparently she killed herself. We have the passage of the moon goddess in the bathtub, a classic old trope from the Illuminati. The moon goddess passes over in the bathtub. If you don't know why this matters, if you listen, I've done a few, didn't I do a full episode on decoding the symbolism of the bathtub? There's a witchcraft cleansing ritual and the occult, they do it as well. It's the idea of the goddess passing over into the next dimension. That's why the Whitney Houston, Bobby Christina thing was weird. That's why the Matthew Perry cranberries symbolism was weird. Aaron Carter died in the bathtub. Found out his sister just died in a bathtub. Yeah, that's right. His sister just died too in a bathtub. Rituals. Kim Kardashian, they put her in the bathtub and threatened her life. That's when Kanye lost his mind. Remember that? It's because he knew that was the Illuminati threat, putting her in the bathtub at the hotel in Paris. So here we go. Venetia's going out the same way. So the dad, James, he's like, Oliver, you got to go. But Oliver says, look, your mom, you know, your wife, Elspeth, she wants me around. And it's probably best that I actually don't leave. James pulls out a checkbook and says, how much? You need to go. And you never need, and you never talk to my wife again. And the next thing you see, Oliver's packing his bags. He must have got the check and he's out. Some period of time goes by. It's implied that we're post-pandemic because in the scene, the next scene, you see people with masks work at a cafe or whatever. So we went from 2006 to presumably modern day-ish time frame. And Oliver's at the coffee shop. He's reading the obituary about how the thought that James actually died. He's dead now. So presumably his agreement for the check is now off. So now he can actually talk to Elspeth. And guess who shows up at the cafe? My goodness, it's Elspeth. What a coincidence. And she invites Oliver to come stay at Saltburn. Isn't that something? Now we're back to present day. Oliver's narrating. He's been there a few months. And this is where things ramp up, right? We see Elspeth. She's on a ventilator. And Oliver's blowing smoke in her face. And he's revealing to us everything that happened. And why he did what he did. It's the big reveal. Take a listen.
I can honestly say that these last few months have been the happiest of my life. It's just such a shame you got so ill. It's been a privilege to look after you. Just as it'll be a privilege to look after Saltburn. So thank you for trusting me. I promise I'll look after this house just as Felix would have. We got there in the end, didn't we? Somehow. Thank God. After all those terrible, terrible accidents. But is there really ever such a thing as an accident, Elspeth? I don't know. Accidents are for people like you. And for the rest of us, there's work. And unlike you, I actually know how to work. I don't have any money. Could I just pay you tomorrow?
What actually happened?
He sent an email to Sotheby's to say that he'd come buy some Palissy plates.
I've actually just bought a little flat nearby. Oliver,
I wasn't in love with him. I know everyone thought I was, but I wasn't. I loved him. By God, I loved him. Sometimes I hated him. Dog sleeping belly up. No natural predators. Well, almost none.
So we find out that Oliver had Elspeth sign over Saltburn. There's no one left in her family. He killed them all, basically. He had drugged Felix with his liquor bottle. He had either killed or provided blades for Venetia to kill herself in the bathtub. I don't think he had anything to do with James's death, the father. He was just waiting for that to happen. And, then he kills the mom, kills Elspeth. And he says, unlike you, I know how to work. And we see about how he, you know, manipulated all these events, right? And he says he loved Felix, but sometimes he actually hated him. And he hated all of them. They were spoiled dogs sleeping belly up with no natural predators. So it's a real class warfare thing, which I'm not opposed to sometimes. It's like, you know, obviously not to the point of violence, but, you know, like these elites, I'm sure they try to take it out on the blue collar folks sometimes at some point in their life. But Oliver takes it to the next level, like a psychopath, right? He killed everyone. And then he finishes off in the most horrific manner by yanking out the mom's ventilator breathing tube. Like he's starting a lawnmower. It's very disturbing. And you'll also notice the room is red, like the lunch scene, right? Because the painting in the room is red. But anyway, but notice that before he pulls the vent tube from Elspeth's throat, again with the throat, right? He's actually slithering up her body, very much like Bob does in Twin Peaks. Yeah. You know, if you're following Twin Peaks, you already know this, but Bob kind of moves in a slithery, snaky way, and that's what Oliver does. I think they channeled some Twin Peaks in here. So then we get the denouement, right? Oliver now took over Saltburn, and we see the statue of Theseus slaying the Minotaur, the murder on the dance floor, the house music playing. And Oliver, he's nude. He's dancing around the house, free as a bird, doing lines of coke. It's his place now. And he wraps up by looking at the puppet box of the jesters of the Catton family with their stones on top of each box. Like, brutal. Brutal. This guy, it wasn't enough that he wanted to be like them or that he killed them. It's... I don't know, insult to injury. I don't know what the right term is there, but he takes it to that next level, like a psychopath. And, you know, in conclusion, I don't know. Is it so bad to watch a psychopath getting back at the elites that are psychopaths about hoarding wealth and keeping everyone else from getting ahead? I don't know. And it's funny because this, it reminded me of how college was when I went to college. Because I went, I was 23. I had the military GI Bill. I was working full time and going to school full time. So I was busy, right? And I'd go up on campus and it just felt like two different classes, two different worlds. I'd walk around and you'd see people that just, you know, lived on campus or in the dorms or whatever. And they just seemed like they were having the greatest time. Like it was high school all over again. And for me, I was like grinding, man. I was trying to run to my car so I could get back to work. I mean, it was crazy. But I had a bit of this sort of hatred myself. I was like, I hate these people. I hate them. Must be nice to have parents that love you and made sure you went to college. You know, but I was a stubborn, stupid kid, so that was my fault, right? That was my fault. If I would have applied myself as a kid, my parents would have probably figured out a way for me to go to college, maybe. So I'll take ownership of that. But either way, you know, I was the first graduate of college in my family. No one else did it. And it's, you know, I don't know, just two different classes of people, right? And the symbolism, right? The symbolism is all over the movie. The Shakespeare is all over the film. One major conspiracy we didn't talk about was the theory that Francis Bacon is actually the guy who was Shakespeare. There's a listener I've talked to. He did a whole podcast series called The Hidden Life is Best about this exact topic. It's so much to unpack. I couldn't do it. I'm going to get him on here sometime, I promise you. But it's a massive rabbit hole. I listened to the whole series. It's fascinating. A lot of occult messaging in there. It's a massive rabbit hole, the Francis Bacon Shakespeare connection there. Then we got the stag horns. Oliver wears those stag horns, and it's symbolic, right? Because the deer is symbolically is the messenger to the gods. We talked about this on the Leave the World Behind movie, right? The stag is the symbol of rebirth and renewal, right? It also says stags are associated with fertility, male sexuality, virility, and so on. And what do you think homeboy's doing there? The stag points to the male sexuality, and that's what homeboy's doing. And, you know, he's the white stag. He shows the spiritual journey of man and the salvation. It's the salvation for Oliver, though, right? Which is very self-centered. Which, you know, for this film, maybe that makes sense. And you're not supposed to like his character, really. Because you kind of feel like Felix seemed like a nice guy, right? Farley seemed like a jerk, and the family seemed awful, but Felix seemed like a nice guy. But the point is, Oliver is in a very self-serving position, which is the religion of Luciferianism and the Church of Satan. Man is God. And social Darwinianism of, you know, every man should do what's best for him kind of thing. Then you've got this sort of bull symbolism. Could it be the Moloch of child sacrifice? I mean, plenty of people die. Plenty of people are killed, so maybe, right? Goes back to the Greek mythology of Theseus slaying the Minotaur. He was half man, half bull. Had the head and tail of a bull, but the body of a man. We also saw that they used to meet up at the pub called the Bull. And then, you know, there's the statues with the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, and that's where Felix is murdered. Also, Farley wears I can't tell if it's a horse or a bull's head for his costume at the final birthday party. But, and you know, the Labyrinth connects in there too. The Minotaur was at the center of the Labyrinth. This goes back to the original story of the Labyrinth in Greek mythology with King Minos of Crete. And, you know, we already talked about how the Labyrinth symbolically represents, it induces vertigo and induces the setting for madness. And that's where the things kick off in this movie with the Thanatos, the death of Felix. And that takes us to the idea of the sex and death, the Eros Thanatos. In the Midsummer Night's Dream in Shakespeare, of course, a major theme, like we already talked about, that was the theme of the birthday party, and you see a million references to Shakespeare. I'm going to read you one interpretation of Midsummer Night's Dream. In 1981, Mordecai Marcus argued for a new meaning of Eros, love, and Thanatos, death, in this play. In his view, Shakespeare suggests that love requires the risk of death. Love achieves force and direction from the interweaving of the life impulse and the deathward release of sexual tension. He also viewed the play as suggesting that the healing force of love is connected to the acceptance of death and vice versa. So let's unpack that a little more. The idea here was popularized in the 1920 book Beyond the Pleasure Principle by Sigmund Freud. And he says that everyone had two instinctual drives, one for life and one for death. And later, psychologists refer to it as Eros and Thanatos. But Eros is the life instinct or sex instinct to form living creations and higher unities, social awareness. Meanwhile, Thanatos is a drive towards death and destruction. And in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, there's a story about, which I saw that. I saw the world's greatest actor, Leonardo DiCaprio. I saw that Romeo and Juliet movie. It was good. But that story shows the idea of the fusion of Eros and Thanatos in the end with love and death combined. Because obviously you know how that movie ends. Eros is about cooperation to keep the species alive and well, procreating, surviving. It's the instinct to drink or eat or to avoid pain. And the energy for this is called libido. And in Latin, that means desire. Most people refer to it as sex, but it actually just means the energy of desire. Whereas on the other polarity, you have Thanatos, and it's all about dominance and self-destructive, risky behavior, smoking, drinking, riding motorcycles, risky, dangerous activities. Sometimes it's about revisiting traumas. Freud said that the aim of all life is death. And this, the Thanatos drive, the energy gets channeled oftentimes outwards through dominance, aggression, fighting, wars, because otherwise it gets channeled inward and that becomes self-loathing and suicide. Now, if any of this is ringing a bell, it's because we looked at this idea with eyes wide shut in the many episodes we did about that show, about that movie, I mean, and of course our beloved Twin Peaks. And it's interesting because there are parallels to the secret societies and their initiation rituals, like how they have a facing death ritual to be reborn, and sex being part of sex magic, which is the foundation of all ritual magic. And in Saltburn, there seems to be a lot of love with the risk of death, and these two worlds constantly overlapping. The most obvious is when Oliver is trying to screw the corpse of Felix through the dirt. And of course, like I talked about with Josie on our Breaking Social Norms analysis of Saltburn, isn't it interesting that we have this, the social construct of male and female at play here. Whereas women are seen as the nurturers with the love and the life instinct and they're more into cooperation. You know, I'm speaking very stereotypically as this social construct of a female. It's about keeping keeping the family fed and people comfortable and worrying about the society and trying to keep everybody procreating and surviving and living. Whereas the male sort of warrior aspect is all about dominance and aggression and war. Like that's what quote unquote a real man is into, fighting and guns and wars and MMA and all this stuff. Right. So it is interesting to see those two elements sort of playing off of each other. And in fact, in the movie, there's a checkerboard in the bathroom when Oliver approaches Felix at the birthday party. There's an obvious checkerboard. Another theme is that of the doppelganger, which means double walker, and it refers to an alter ego or a double spirit. In Saltburn, they talked about how Percy Shelley drowned, and a few weeks later, Mary Shelley claimed that he actually saw his doppelganger right before he died. And we talked about how during that scene, you can see the doppelganger of Felix walk by. Fun fact, there's a famous poet named John Donne who saw his wife's doppelganger in Paris. If that name rings a bell, it's because we talked about John Donne in the Oppenheimer movie analysis. Because that's Oppenheimer chose the name Trinity for the Trinity site, supposedly because it's a reference to John Donne, who talks about the Trinity. But you see the doppelganger idea in many different ways in the film. Oliver looks into a mirror and breaks it. When he transitions into full killer mode, he stares into the mirror. There's a couple shots of a as above, so below sequences where he's kind of looking at a reflection on the dinner table or at the pond smoking and things like that. And the idea is that there's a dark side, there's a shadow side, a doppelganger for Oliver even. We talked about, do you remember back around March 2020, we talked about Kobe Bryant's kids' books that he wrote about? And the one book was called The Tree of Ecroff, and it's about a kid who makes a pact with a Luciferian figure in exchange for athletic abilities. What a crazy idea that is. And in the story, her name is Precia, and she would use this magic that he called Granna to compete in sports. And on the inside cover, there's a tree of life and death, again with those opposing polarities of life and death, Eros Thanatos. But anyways, Precia uses magic and a Luciferian pact to be good at basketball, wink, wink, and her shadow self appears and it's sort of her shadow helps her be better at sports, but it makes her too aggressive, and she almost kills these other kids. And the academy that she's at, they're trying to teach her, like, look, you got to let that shadow take over. You got to embrace your shadow. And the books wrap up. The book wraps up with her, spoiler alert, her uncle praying to this fallen god. And she's like, what are you doing? And he says, well, you know, evil isn't always bad. And that's the book. That's the kid's book. If you don't believe me, listen to my, go back to, I think it was around February or March of 2020 when Kobe Bryant died. I deep dived into two of his kid's books that he wrote, and man, illuminate confirm, bro. But anyways, a lot of this doppelganger stuff ties into Twin Peaks, as you'll hear when we get into those episodes for the Grey Lodge. And I had read that Lord Byron used doppelgangers to portray the duality of human nature. But it's all about exploring the shadow side, and the director confirmed it. The director said, my favorite thing in general is sympathy for the devil. And that's what this movie's about, right? And Oliver embraces his shadow, his devil, and he's the puppet master now. He's the puppet master over the Catton family, fueled by his desire, his libido, to be them. You see the duality of light and dark represented in Eros and Thanatos throughout the film, embracing the shadow and so on. The film is an actual moving checkerboard. It's checkerboard in a moving picture. And Oliver's final manifesto, he lays it all out. He says he wasn't in love with Felix. He loved him, but sometimes he hated him. And the hate, the embracing of the dark side, the shadow, is what allowed him to kill them. So that's why he is that's the spiritual evolution of Oliver. He embraced the shadow, and you get murder and mayhem. So there you go. Great movie, I guess, kind of. But that's the bonus episode for January. I want to thank you for being a supporter, keeping this show alive. I say that, I mean that. I really do appreciate you guys letting me do my research and hearing me out and supporting the show. So thank you very much. Hope all is well with you guys. Normally I tell people to do something at this point, but you guys already do the things. You're already supporting. So thank you very much for your support. Till next time, stay woke.